Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
The Science of Sports podcast with Professor Ross Tucker and sports journalist Mike Finch.
Hey everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Science of Sport. I'm Ross Tucker and I'm still in Paris. Tonight, of course, the opening match of the 2023 Rugby World Cup. The excitement is building. There are lots of people now walking around the streets wearing rugby jerseys, clearly here for the start of this tournament, and it kicks off tonight with what should be an absolutely spectacular match. I must say I'm most looking forward to hearing the French anthem with 80,000 people belting it out. One of the other things I've done while I was in Paris is bump into a friend of mine, a man who I've known for a decade, who I hardly ever see. And the reason I hardly ever see him is because he's pretty much always on an adventure somewhere, usually a bicycle one. And that person is Ron Rutland. And I took an opportunity. He finished a ride from New Zealand all the way across to South America. He then went up the coast of South America and then into the United States, across the USA and across Europe to get here. And it's something that he's done. This is the fourth time he's done it. He's going to tell you the story about how all of this came about. And he finished in Paris yesterday. And I said, listen, can we please catch up over coffee and just chat? And I thought, let me record that conversation for a podcast. So this is a little bit different. It's not as technical or as scientific. Sometimes it veers into philosophy. You'll hear stories about near-death experiences with mudslides, adopted dogs, illness, Ron's battles with frostbite and weather conditions. It really has been a remarkable life from a remarkable person, and I was very fortunate to sit down with him this morning and have this conversation. And so you're in effect eavesdropping on it. I'm saying that because you'll notice there's a little bit of background noise. We were in a hotel and there was a little bit going on. At one point, one of Ron's fans came over to congratulate him. So that happened as well. So yeah, I hope you'll forgive that, a little bit of interruption, a bit different. But I hope that you'll also enjoy it and take some insights from Ron's adventures. It's quite astonishing. There have been a few times in the last decade that I've looked at what he's done with a degree of envy and said, I wish I could join him for even 3 months of it. And he's done it for, 10 years, not uninterrupted. But you'll hear the story straight from him and hopefully enjoy learning about the man who cycled around the world. Enjoy it. So welcome to the Science of Sports. I'm just going to set the scene for you here. I'm sitting in a hotel lobby in Paris. A few hundred meters maybe from the Arc de Triomphe, which is appropriate. Also, as I walked from the metro station, I managed to catch one small peek of the top of the Eiffel Tower, which is also appropriate because those who've been to Paris would know that the top of the Eiffel Tower is a restaurant in it called, do you know?
Oh, I don't.
The Jules Verne restaurant.
Oh, right.
Jules Verne was a writer who wrote the book Around the World in 80 Days, which told the story of Phileas Fogg. And the man sitting opposite the table to me in this hotel restaurant is the Phileas Fogg of cycling, who has gone around the world, not in 80 days, but in 4 World Cup cycles. And that is Ron Rutland. Ron, thank you very much for your time.
No, Ross, absolute pleasure. And it's a great thrill to be sitting here. I think we're waiting for a cup of coffee, so looking forward to that arriving.
That's good context. We've just ordered a cup of coffee each. We're in a fairly bustly hotel lobby. So think of this as eavesdropping on a conversation, and hopefully that'll allow you to forgive the noise and the background hum. But hopefully it'll be clear. So you're obviously a hard man to pin down, because you said to me last night, we had a function, that you had spent how many nights sleeping in different places?
Over the last 10 years, which I guess is 3,650 days approximately, yeah. I've probably spent at least 2,000 of those sleeping in different places. So that's probably the kind of sums up the last 10 years of my life.
So why? By way of introduction, tell us why you are nomadic. What have you been doing for those 10 years?
Okay,
let's go back
a little bit. So 2013, living in Cape Town.
Coffee's arrived. Interruptions. Yes, thank you.
I'm sorry to interrupt.
No, not at all.
Cappuccino and the Americano?
Cappuccino. Americano. Merci.
Thank you.
It looks much better than normal French coffee does.
Yeah. Very good.
So in 2013, sitting in Cape Town, I'd spent wonderful 5 years there, running the Cape Town Tens. It's a rugby tournament. I started there in 2008, 2009.
Mm-hmm.
I moved to Cape Town from Hong Kong, where I was living at the time, or living before, and had never really done trail running or mountain biking, but kind of just got sucked into both of those.
You were a rugby player?
Yeah, so fat ex-prop, right? Correct, yeah.
All your mates were very quick to tell me that last night at the function.
Yeah, were they? Yeah.
Oh, yes.
So, but I was a enthusiastic amateur at best, but I played rugby sort of, until 2013, as it turns out.
Mm-hmm.
And, I moved to Cape Town, got into a bit of trail running and mountain biking. Wasn't very good at either of them particularly, but sort of had a decent tractor or sort of diesel engine. It was a great way to explore Cape Town, the city I hardly knew, the Western Cape. And I'd always read these stories as a kid and as an adult about people doing crazy big adventures. So whether cycling around the world or overland from Cairo to Cape Town on a motorbike. I'd always read these stories and be like so inspired. Think, oh, wouldn't it be amazing to do something like that? But then the follow-on thought of my mind is, but obviously those people are more richer or better athletes and all these other excuses.
Just out of interest though, had you done anything even at a tiny scale like it, or had you only just read it? Like, were you thinking about adventure as let me do more of something, or was it just this thing and you were going to go do a new? Were you imitating or were you just imagining? Is basically the point.
That's a good. I'd lived. So the first 21 years of my life were very unadventurous. I think as a family, I grew up outside Durban. I think my entire first 18 years of my life anywhere was probably within a 50k radius of Durban. I think we had two or three family holidays down to like Mams and Toti. It was probably as much as we travelled as a family. But after university, I actually got an opportunity to go play rugby in Australia for a season. And my plan was to go and play for 6 months, save a bit of money, travel for 6 months, come back to South Africa and get on with my life. But that was 12 years I was away. And I tried, I worked in different careers and different sort of businesses. And I became very well travelled. And within that environment, I did some short, adventurous trips. Mm. Like I would rent a motorbike, buy a motorbike and go and travel through Laos or Vietnam for a couple of weeks here and there, okay. But purely as holidays, I guess. Yeah, adventurous holidays.
Mm-hmm.
But when I was, in terms of what I would consider a real big life changing adventure, it was always just imagined, really. It was always like, it was something that was just completely out of my realm of possibility, or I believe was completely out the realm of possibility. And I think the key for me, after reading all these stories, was actually starting to meet some people that actually done some of these things.
Mm.
For me, that was a really important moment. It wasn't like a particular light bulb moment where I was saying I'm going to sell everything, buy a bicycle and start through Africa. It was just a sort of drip feeding of like meeting people and going, if that person can do that, he's not not a greater athlete than me, or he's not, he's not a trust fund kid or something like that. And I said, that's complete BS. That I can't do this. And then with that sort of realization in mind, and I'd never, I'd probably spent 3 or 4 nights of my life at a tent before I left on my first trip.
And that first trip, I imagine at the time, and this is about the time I met you, you would have had a few options in mind for what to do.
Yeah.
But the one you landed on, tell us what eventually became journey number one.
Yeah. So I was sitting, I bought a map of Africa, old school, old fashioned paper map.
Yeah.
And I plotted a route from Cape Town to Cairo. So it's a classic African overland trip. I think it's roughly 10,000 kilometers off the top of my head,
mm-hmm. up
roughly the east coast of Africa. It's pretty well documented. People do it on motorbikes, overland vehicles.
Yeah, cyclists even.
Cyclists. There's a Tour d'Afrique, which is the reverse. So Cairo to Cape Town, fully supported like 4 months, I think. Pay $10,000 or $15,000 and it's great, it'd be a great adventure. So there's a lot of resources to lean into. And then I looked at this map of Africa and I looked at the country that I was missing and Uganda stands out. So I've heard so much about Uganda.
Yeah.
So let me add Uganda into the route, which sort of means you head inland a little bit more west. And if I've got to go to Uganda, I might as well go to Burundi and Rwanda. And then from there, I just sort of, more out of curiosity than anything, I wonder if it's possible to find a route that goes through every single country on mainland Africa. And for those of you not from Africa, or even those from you, Africa, there's 48.
Yeah.
It's a lot more than a lot of people think.
Yeah.
And eventually I worked out that theoretically you could get from Cape Town to Cairo, passing through every single all 48 mainland countries
and,
of Africa.
And entering and leaving via different border points.
Yeah, so my definition of going...
You had to go through it. You can't dip in and out.
Yeah, so yeah, that was my definition. Yeah. So, yeah. And, you know, a lot of Google research about which borders are open between different countries. I eventually plotted this route, which was sort of near 35,000 Ks as opposed to 10,000 Ks.
It's a 35,000 kilometer journey.
Yeah, and then I decided after, and then I realized, a bit more research, I realized that nobody had ever attempted a single continuous journey through every country in Africa in any kind of vehicle. So all of a sudden, my 6 month sabbatical, which is what my original plan was now became the sell everything you own, completely change your life journey. And then I just sort of, this is not 2012, I'm planning it. The Rugby World Cup was taking place in England in 2015. So I kind of then tied on the sort of final element of the journey, is, you know, give myself something to aim for. But from a time point of view, because once I get to Cairo, if I've got a bit of time left, then cycle through as much of Europe as I can to get to England for the World Cup in 2015. Yeah. So that's how my first ride started.
So we love a bit of stats, obviously, here. So we're gonna bank some stats as we go through Ron's last 10 years. So we've got 35,000 Ks, 48 countries.
And just to update you on that one, sorry, that was the plan. It ended up being 42,000 Ks through about 70 countries.
Yeah, because you still are going to get from Cairo all the way up to London.
Yeah, and I zigzagged through, but I had a bit of time in the end. I finished that African leg a little bit. I think it took about 22 months in the end to complete the African leg.
Yeah, so that was
going to
be my next question, was the time. We know at the distance, and we've got the number and the time.
So it ended up being 27 months from Cape Town to Brighton, as it ended up. Just over 42,000 kilometers through 70 countries.
How much elevation do you know?
That's a very good question. I didn't record it. No, I didn't. It was before I had even heard of Strava or anything like that. But okay. The Simien Mountains in northern Ethiopia, cycling even to Lesotho, the Morocco Atlas Mountains in Morocco. There's a fair amount of climbing in there. Mm. But certainly, I think some of the bigger challenges are probably more sort of cycling across the Sahara in the middle of summer.
Yeah, I want to touch on highs and lows in a moment. But let's first unpack the high level of the last 10 years.
Okay.
So that brings you to London. You then arrive in Brighton and you watch South Africa lose to Japan and save the Rugby World Cup 2019.
Exactly.
Yeah, for which you were credited last night. Then I lose track of when you did the longest hole as opposed to when you started to ride to Tokyo. Which one came first?
Yep. So I finished in 2015. As I say, I literally had sold everything in the world that I owned. If I couldn't get on my bicycle, it was either on, you know, Gumtree or Craigslist or whatever the equivalent is. Mm. So I was in the UK. I obviously spent a bit of time enjoying the World Cup. And I was like, what do you do next? And I kind of like sort of went back to SA for a while, did a bit of speaking and things like that. And then very fortuitously in 2016, I got a phone call from Hong Kong Rugby Union, from the manager of the team. And Hong Kong were touring Kenya for the first time, which was the first time they were touring Africa. And I guess because I'd cycled through Kenya, I was now seen as a bit of an expert. Anyway, so long story short, I ended up in Nairobi as a unofficial liaison officer for Hong Kong Rugby on their two test tour of Kenya.
Uh-huh.
And I lived in Hong Kong, I was very involved in rugby there. So
I would imagine the culture shock from cycling through Africa for 22 months to being in Hong Kong must have been something else.
Yes. And I mean, this is actually in Nairobi. So Hong Kong were touring Kenya.
But you then went back to Hong Kong, right? You did live there for a while.
Hong Kong's like a boomerang city for me. I keep going back.
Okay.
I've lived there three different times.
I was based
in South Africa. Went to Kenya to meet the Hong Kong team.
Got you. Okay.
The first day the coach says to me, Ron, most of these guys have never been to Africa. You've cycled the whole continent. Mm. I just want to share your story. So I sort of gave a bit of a story about my trip around the continent. Mm. And one of the youngsters, he was one of the older guys on the team, but one of the youngsters when I played in Hong Kong, in a previous, before I moved to Cape Town. And he was like, Ron, I followed your whole trip online when you did it. I was only hearing it now firsthand. I realized sort of just how much went into it. He says, I want to do something crazy. And he was a professional rugby player at that stage, but he knew his sort of time was coming. And he said, and he's Irish heritage. He said, maybe I should go to Ireland and hit a golf ball. He's a keen golfer around the coast of Ireland.
Right.
So I said, if you want someone to tell you it's a good idea, you're speaking to the right person. Like, I thought that was a brilliant idea. But then I said, well, Adam, you know, 10 years ago, I went on a rugby tour to Mongolia. And now there's a country you can go and play golf across. It's got these plains that run forever. So over the course of that 10-day trip, when he should have been focusing on rugby, every spare moment we had, him and I sat down with coffees planning what it would take to hit a golf ball across Mongolia.
So you teed off on the western side, and you played all the way across, and he putted in on the eastern side. And I looked this up, 20,093?
bang on.
2,093 shots later, he putted it in at a club at the on the eastern side of
Mongolia. Correct, just outside Ulan Bator, the capital. So it was just over 2,000 kilometers. We did it in 80 days. I think we averaged 25, 26, 27 kilometers. I was a caddy. So I literally had this cart made, which I strapped to my waist, sort of man-hauled it across Mongolia.
Picked the dog up on the way.
Picked the dog up on day three or four.
Delivered it to a family.
Yep.
How's that dog, you know?
Yeah, well, Adam went back to... Yeah, so just to give a bit of context, this dog joined us on day three.
Yeah.
And Andrew King, who you know, was filming the first few days of our trip to make a documentary.
Yeah.
And he was like, this dog might stay with you. And he told us another story about some Mongolian trail race with it. And anyway, this dog walked 77 days with us, almost 2,000 kilometers across Mongolia. And yeah, we found him a home just outside Ulan Bator the day before we left. And Adam actually went back the following summer to go visit him. And unfortunately, he was an old dog. He passed away later after that.
So, good life though. Joined you
what
for
a story
life.
He had to tell his mates. that's the hardest thing I've done in my life.
Yeah, the caddying.
Yeah,
why?
Physically. I mean, that trolley at different stages would have weighed 125 kilos. You know, it's all our water through the Gobi Desert. Sort of had to carry.
It was Adam.
He had a little backpack and he had to swing a golf club. So he had to hit his golf ball. Obviously, his body. I was looking at him and the conditions he was playing off. I mean, thankfully, he's a really, really good golfer.
How many balls do you lose?
Interesting question. We were TaylorMade, you know, they actually gave us a set of clubs and 400 balls, which we guesstimated. We actually only used 150 in the end.
Oh, really?
So I was pretty impressed with it. And we actually measured the distance. We had a very rudimentary app that a tech company in South Africa developed for us. So we
walked, or the shot distance each time you
hit. Yeah, effectively, we measured the start point and the end point of each shot. So it's a crude way of measuring it, but one or two of the balls sort of hit 50 kilometers. One or two of them lasted one shot. And by that time,
so you got a 50k mileage out of a ball.
Out of a ball before it was lost. But so.
What was the longest shot he hit? Because I'd imagine in Mongolia, you could probably get some properly downhill shots and you could just get it rolling and it's going to go.
Well, literally, the drive would have been. It's the only time he used the driver. So he insisted we carried the driver and he teed it up. And he's a scratch golfer, so he's a really good golfer. He absolutely smoked it down this hill in all time ounces. So that would have clearly been the longest. And he tried to hit a 3-wood off the deck once or twice. But he ended up basically just walking with his wedge. And just hitting it about 100 yards every time. Just walk.
That's the average, 20,000 shots in 2,000 Ks.
Yeah, it works out to be about 100 meters of shots.
Not bad going, because sometimes you would have to play it out sideways.
Oh, yeah, a lot of times. And when you get to we had to obviously aim for the towns to get supplies. So every time we got to the town, he would sort of chip through have to chip down the high streets effectively. So people were just looking at us. So we were very strict about the spirit and the rules of the game of golf.
Right, played where it lies.
Yeah, played where it lies.
Let's talk about the physical, because I know that when you left on the Africa trip now, so now we're going back in time, you weren't trained at all on day one.
No, I was literally the fattest and unfittest of my life.
Yeah, and you just got on the bike and off you went. And in fact, your website and campaign started out as Fat Kid on a Bike.
Yeah.
And that was your name for yourself.
Yep.
And I'm just curious about how you understood and assessed and felt fitness gains over that ride. Like what was the experience like in the first week, month, 6 months?
Well, so day one of that journey of 800 and something days, the only day I planned was day one. So I had some friends came to down to Cape Town Stadium to meet me, and we were going to cycle to Franschhoek together. We had a mate who lived there who was going to organize a barbecue for us.
Nigh on 80, 100K?
It's like 80, 85K. Yeah, it's about that. Helshoogte, which is a big climb out of Stellenbosch, the only real climb of the day.
Yeah.
And on a normal road bike, on a normal day, it's a pretty straightforward drive.
But you were carrying heavy,
eh? Yeah, so I'm on a fully loaded touring bike, which I'd never ridden in my life. I was staying with friends up in Greenpoint, which was 2 or 3K from the start. So I rode down to the start line on this bike for the very, very first time. I'll come back to why that was the case.
Yeah.
And a fully loaded touring bike, probably 40 kilos, roughly, and plus me at my heaviest. And it was one of the longest, hardest days of riding, I can imagine. Yeah, but I had friends pushing me up Helshoogte. And I'm sure they were going, my goodness, if one can't get to Franschhoek, how the heck's he ever going to get to London? Mm. And we told people we'd meet you there at 1 o'clock. I think we arrived like three in the afternoon. Thanks to me. And I was in massive pain. I was cramping up Helshoogte.
Abductors,
sort of like
abductors. So that's just conditioning, because you're pushing such a heavy load.
Yeah, and I've been sedentary, and going back to why I was so I'm one of those people that. Basically, if I stop exercising, I just balloon very, very quickly. And I got roped into playing a rugby match in February or so of that year, which is now, I was supposed to leave, and I think originally said the 1st of May I was going to leave. Got roped into this charity rugby match, broke my wrist off the kickoff. It was quite a complicated break. So I ended up having two operations on it. So I had to push the start date back 2 months in the end, but on the advice of my doctor, I just couldn't do anything. So in that period of time, the bicycle that I ordered online had arrived. So and obviously got that all set up. And yeah, so basically from February to June when I left, I did zero exercise. So I just couldn't do, I was literally doing nothing. Yeah. So that sort of explains the fatness and the toughness of day one. Day two.
So your friends are pushing you, thinking, no doubt, how's this guy going to do this?
Has he bitten off more than he should?
What were you thinking?
No, I knew I was going to do it. It's incredible.
So it didn't bother you that you said, and why? Like, did you know that the fitness would emerge, or did it just not bother you that you felt like you could do this and suffer for as long as it took?
Yeah, I mean, I guess having played a lot of sports and things like that, I guess I quite enjoy suffering. I'm fine with that. It was more just the mentality. Like, I sold everything, Ross. I was all in on this. It wasn't like
a Viking, burn the boats kind of approach.
That's exactly what it was. Burning the boats. I gave myself no choice. And I always I don't know why, this random, I said, unless I get crushed or hit by a truck in the Congo, I know I'm going to get to Brighton. I'm all in on this. And I've read so many stories about just people sticking things out, perseverance. I've read all these, you know, again, like, time I have to get fit. I was an absolute mess that day one. And day two, I could hardly walk day two. But now I was on my own, and I've just, you know, but I plugged on, I've climbed up, up the back of Franschhoek. You go, come in the name of the fastest, you Franschhoek Pass, I guess.
You end up at the dam, right?
Yep, and exactly.
You drop down into that dam.
And it was like, I mean, that's one of the longest days. I think I got to 25 Ks that day. I mean, it took all day, but I was determined not to push. I mean, I stopped on that climb two or three times. Eventually got to the top, found a place just as a bit of a side note, I was still going to be camping, my first night of camping, and then somebody bumps into me at getting a milkshake or whatever, invites me into their home, and that really set the tone. And then his daughter farmed like 80 k's down the road, so I cycled there the next day. But I can probably remember, I would say day 10 or 12, thinking back now, somewhere in the Karoo, a few hundred k's from Cape Town. It was probably one day I just woke up.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, your fitness either emerges gradually and slowly, or very slowly and then all at once.
Yeah, it really, it was like that for me. It was incredible. I mean, you can probably explain why that happens how that happens.
I have no idea. I just note from my own experience as well, is that you put in work, you put in work, you put in work, and you're suffering and it's not happening, and then all of a sudden, it's like a light switch that says.
That's exactly what happened. And it was amazing. It was like weight off my shoulders. I mean, obviously some very, very long days ahead, but in the future forward. But from there, it was just, I just felt good and strong.
And compare now that to pulling the 120. It was 120.
Depending on water, it's up to 120, 125 kilos.
Compare that to pulling that. I mean, because that's almost one of the things with fitness is the load you put on yourself can cause adaptation, which is what you describe on your cycle, or it can cause failure. Where you actually never get on top of that load. It's just always more than you can handle. And with a sled, did you get on top of it eventually?
So it was on wheels. So it was a trolley on wheels.
Yeah, the trolley.
I mean, the first hour, 2 hours of that journey, I thought we made a terrible mistake.
Really?
It was, you know, the Altai Mountains, it's pretty wet down there. The cart got stuck. Mm. So I was having to, like, literally, Adam would obviously help me pull this cart out of the swamp.
Yeah.
So the first few days were really tough until we sort of hit the river valley, and it was a lot flatter. So it was amazing. When I sort of had the rolling resistance wasn't that much and it was flat, it was actually super easy to put. Mm. As soon as there was any sort of incline or any sort of, you know, rough terrain, that's when I really noticed it. I mean, there were times when I had walking sticks, sort of checking poles. Sometimes it got to a point where I was actually like having to haul up these passes and these saddles over different valleys.
Just for the listeners, that documentary is still available, right?
If you go
called The Longest Hole.
Yeah, thelongesthole.com, I think it is the website. So you can go and watch it there.
I'll put this in the show notes, folks. It's thelongestholefilm.com.
Yeah, correct.
And it's made by a mutual mate, like a really good mate of yours and mutual friend, Andrew King.
Andrew King, yeah.
So what we'll do is we'll pop that show note and go have a look at it, because you had some proper advances on
it was well.
Unbelievable footage as well.
Yeah, and the first few days of that, it was obviously these doubts about whether we'd... I mean, I was very confident of the route, but it was the more the equipment I was a bit concerned about. And, I mean, I'd had a hip operation about a year before to clean out a bit of loose debris in my hip. I've had two ankle operations as well leading up to that, or just in the yo-yo. So I really was hobbling The first sort of 2-3 weeks, I mean, it was every step of my ankle was really, really sore. And again, it just all of a sudden clicked, and I was actually fine. I mean, it was just, but I was at the end of that trip, the lightest I've ever been. The first time I've been under 90 kilograms, probably since I was 15 years old.
Really?
So I think that it was hard to get enough calories.
I want to talk about the calories as well. Like, actually, maybe let's do that now. Yeah. So, there's the cycle we've spoken about. There was the caddying, the longest haul. And then there were actually three more rides, but let's get onto those in a bit. Mm. Just in terms of nutrition, like, what was it, 42,000 K. This last trip was 22,000 K in 300 days. You are on the bike for 7 to 9 hours a day, 10 hours?
No, normally six to seven hours.
Six to seven hours. Even conservatively, that's 3,500 calories on the bike, plus your daily. So, and you're in remote places. How do you eat?
Yeah, so I've got a very strict seafood diet. Yeah, so I see food and I eat it. And
it's like banking food.
I just eat food. I mean, I always have two portions. Not literally every time, but I'll often just have. Yeah. But you do have a lot of.
What are you carrying though?
So I've got a handlebar bag.
Yeah.
And in the handlebar bag, I've got a strict rule of always having some sort of snacks. Often that is just cheap sugary biscuits or nuts or local chocolate bars or. Sometimes bread and, you know, made sandwiches or something like that. So I've always got something to hand to snack on. But one thing I have learned is wherever there's people, there's food.
That's true.
And the way that Africa was a little bit exception, there's some pretty remote places where there weren't many people around. But on my last couple of trips, even in the most remote places, you're always seeing somebody within probably 40, 50 kilometers. So you're not completely off piste, you know. So if you're following sort of roughly from town to town to town. So there's always a cafe or a grocery store or a restaurant or... Often you people invite you into their homes to eat.
And when you walked into one of those stores, what's the first thing you were looking for?
That's a very, very good question. It's a completely, you know, you'd be cycling in Japan, the 7-Elevens there are like some of the best food you get around.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, I remember buying sushi there because I was, you were there as well, 2019, and there was that typhoon, remember?
Yes.
Haggibus or something.
Haggis or something like that.
Haggibus, And everything was being shut down, and I dashed out to the 7-Eleven and I bought a sushi meal. It was very good.
It's really, really good. Mayo sandwiches are, I think Anthony Bourdain says, it's one of his best meals he's had. There's limitless supply, and that's a good, I mean, sushi would be one. Call me the name, the other just sort of these rice balls with salmon inside. Sandwiches, things like that.
And so were you consciously aware? Obviously, you were the seafood concept meant that you were aware, like, I just got to get calories in because I know I'm consuming so many a day.
Or else, I mean,
were you ever aware that you were running a deficit for quite a long time? Was there a moment where you said, actually, geez, I'm consistently hungry and this is not good. I have to change this pattern.
Yeah, I think Central Asia in 2019, it was really tough to find. I wouldn't say I force fed myself, but I really would make an effort to not feel any. Yeah, because I mean, again, I've listened to every one of your. I've had plenty of time. I listened to all your podcasts, and I listen. You know, so you, in terms of like, I think you talk about eat when you're hungry, drink when you're thirsty. And don't think too much more about it than that.
So you make it more complicated than it needs to be.
So yeah, that's kind of what it becomes.
But you didn't have a sort of go-to sports drink product. You just available.
Yeah, I've consumed more Coke in the last 10 years of my life than I could ever imagine consuming. You're just looking for sugar hits.
And 500 ml Coke, what's that? That's 200 grams? No. 10%, right? That's 50 grams, 200 calories. That's gone in 30 minutes.
Yeah, but often I would be getting a 2-liter Coke. The thing I crave the most is cold things. A cold drink or cold water. Because often your water bottle's the same temperature as the air thing. So that's what I find myself diving for the first time I get it. In a lot of places, it's not like, you know, we come from South Africa, everything's refrigerated. But the other parts of the world where things are, you know, more temperate climate where things are just on the shelf and, you know, there's a little remote convenience store. You get there and it's just, you know, warm water, warm Cokes on the shelf.
So you just want something cold.
Yeah, so...
Were you monitoring anything related to your adaptation, like sleep? And obviously you're not monitoring energy intake. It's not like you can do that in the midst of this journey. But were you monitoring it or were you just listening to your body?
No, I was just listening to my body, to be honest, yeah. I mean, I think in hindsight, I think we spoke about this last night, I would love to have done some sort of, taken a bit more seriously and, you know, I would have loved to have done something, you know, just out of curiosity. You know, worn a heart rate monitor the whole time and...
You didn't do that at all?
No, pretty much the whole, pretty much the whole way from, for example, Tokyo to Auckland I did. And then from, pretty much the first half of this last trip and then the battery eventually died and I kind of gave up on that.
What about sleep? Were you sleeping like a baby or was it difficult to sleep?
I sleep, that's the one thing, you get a lot of sleep. I mean, often when you're camping, you just sort of, towards the end of the day, you're looking for a good place to put up a tent. You put your tent up, you have your cook, you boil some 2 minute noodles, go to sleep. And then you often go to sleep basically at sunset. And even on a like little blow up mattress, after 6, 7, 8 hours of cycling, you know, 10 days in a row, sleep's not difficult at all. You know, sometimes it gets a bit cold or a bit hot and things like that. But from I would often have 10, 11 hours sleep.
And illness?
Yeah, that's probably because the biggest downers of these trips is when you do get ill. And
your immune system has to be suppressed to some degree by all the exercise.
So that's and this trip for the first time, it really, I had my biggest wobble of all my journey. So I was in Central America.
We still have to tell the listeners what all these trips were. So you're kind of getting teasers here, listeners. But we'll get there. But go on,
America. Yeah, so Central America. Yeah. We'll have to come give you some more context. Basically, been on the road over a year, and it was. I mean, the heat is just incomprehensible. How hot it was. The hottest time of the year. The humidity. And I struggle. I'm from born and bred in Durban, a humid part of South Africa. And I've just never really adapted to
it. You were in Costa Rica, right?
Yeah.
I was in Costa Rica in October, and geez, it was heavy.
That's beautiful, but it was some of the that was
jungle,
some,
like proper jungle.
Yeah, and I just you talk about I felt so depleted on every level, and I picked up some sort of fever, but like very minor underlying fever, and I took a couple of days off here and then I just couldn't shake it, and eventually I just got and I was just so depleted is the best description I had. I just was completely worn out and I was falling further and further behind my sort of required kilometers to get to ultimately to here today. And so eventually I decided, I took the pragmatic decision, you know what, this is my journey, my adventure. And I've always been so strict about covering every inch of a bicycle and being as perfect as I can be. But I took the decision that I need some proper time off. So I actually flew ahead to Mexico City.
Okay.
Got a cheap Airbnb and I took about 4 weeks off. And I was all focused on food. So there's a grocery store just down the road. I made a conscious decision to probably eat 500 grams, so a kilogram of fruit and vegetables a day. That's what I was just like. I really just binged out.
So in actual fact, your body maybe was telling you that despite all your efforts to access food on the way and how, let's not say plentiful, but available food was, you probably were still falling below the bar.
Yeah, so I think I think there's a big difference between, I was getting enough calories to survive and cycle, but I think I was just, the nutrition was just, you eat so much bad food. The quality of food, and you know, obviously on a budget as well. So you know, it's you're often just choosing the cheapest option wherever you go. So I think that it made a huge difference. So in the 4 weeks, just binging on good food, basically, I slept well. You know, going back to it, I normally sleep well, but obviously because I was a bit sick, I was struggling to sleep. It was so hot, and trying to camp in that sort of weather, it was just a recipe. Everything was just unraveling, really. And then a full it was about 4 weeks in the end. I'd still go for walks, so it wasn't just completely rest. But that was that gave me the second wind that I needed for the next what's turned out to be 4 or 5 months. And I've actually been felt awesome since then.
Okay, so we have jumped a little bit back and forth in your 10-year journey here. So we had the Africa trip, which we still want to touch on some things. You had the longest haul, and then comes cycling trip two, right? So that's
the biggest takeaway from the African trip for me is that I dreamt up the hardest thing I could possibly dream of doing on a bicycle, and I pulled it off. And that sort of midlife confidence boost, I mean, I had 3 birthdays in a row. So I started as a 38-year-old, pretty unsure of myself. I finished as a 41-year-old who sort of just had this most wild adventure and, as I say, managed to pull it off. A lot of people, I think people were sort of, as you say, day one we referenced, but physically was I going to make it? And there's a lot of concerns about, you know, all the concerns that people often have about Africa.
Did you ever feel unsafe?
I
don't know. And again, I'm interrupting you now because we're still going to build your journey. But did you ever feel unsafe on that trip and think to yourself, oh my God, this is bad, I could die here?
I guess dozens of times, but 99 out of 100 those vehicle related. So it's trucks overtaking on a blind rise. And I think whether you're cycling in Paris or Cape Town or Lagos.
Yeah. Every cyclist in the world listening to this is nodding.
Yeah, exactly. So that for me is overall, is all these trips put together. That's been the biggest. I've only ever been actually hit once. Unfortunately, it was a side shot. And I was actually in Senegal. And a truck sort of, bus, like a sort of 30-seater bus, hit me from the side. And that was obviously in the moment, you know, like a very frightening thing. But I was a bit battered and bruised. And actually, remember emailing your friend Jeroen, Dr. Swart, well, come how I did in those days, or what's up. But so the truck, the bus hit me on my, you ride it, you drive, or you cycle on the right-hand side there. And the front right of the bus hit my, well, it actually, where it hit was my tricep. So that was the point of contact.
Right.
And it was, so that was bruised. Obviously, I was a bit scratched and grazed when I say hit the road. But that's, I thought I'd possibly broken whatever the top. This bone, yeah. So anyway, fortunately, just a few days off. It was a bit, I felt a bit sore for a while, but but otherwise, and then I've once incident one day in Nigeria from a group of youths who were giving me a bit of trouble. That's the only time. We'll come to stats later. I'll come back to wrap up some stats, but that's the only time in all my journeys that I've actually felt directly threatened by a human being.
By a human being.
Once in all those journeys.
Interesting, eh? Because people would be, hey, can't do that. You'll get killed.
But Ross, there's something about a bicycle, particularly a touring bike. Yeah. That makes you, is universally relatable. People understand a bicycle.
Except if you're in a car, then you're no longer a human.
Well, yes, but that's sometimes the argument against wearing helmets, against wearing big yellow things. But if you're in a big summer, you know, I wear like a big cricket hat, basically, like a big floppy. I'm much more concerned about sun cancer, or, you know, basically cancer and getting sunburned. But, but yeah, so there's something that makes you human. You know, big bicycle, people, you know, you've got the big luggage. I've got flags on the back of my bike now. Not for any sort of safety reason. It's just to sort of,
so
know,
people are more inclined to support you than to threaten you.
Oh, yeah. Oh, but Ross, that's for me is my biggest takeaway from my African trip is sub-Saharan Africa is the poorest place on the planet, in inverted commas, you know, depending on how you, economists will tell you. But, and that's the thing, cycling strips you down to your basics. All you're really thinking about is food, water, and shelter. And that's what 95% of people in sub-Saharan Africa are mostly concerned about. You know, how am I going to get food and water for my family and shelter? And then this strange white guy on a bicycle comes across this village in the middle of Mozambique or wherever, and the first thing people do is offer food and water, which is their most valuable resource. And often, some probably a woman, most likely, has probably carried their water from a river, possibly kilometers away, and without any expectation of anything in return. And that, for me, is my lived experience of cycling through Africa, through Somalia, through Sudan, Chad, Equatorial Guinea, all these places that are only ever in the news when there's bad conflict stuff happens and conflict and things like that. And we get this impression that's what our entire country's like all the time. Everybody's out to get you. And honestly, my experience, all I can just say is from my lived experience, that's completely the opposite.
Fascinating. So, okay. You're now invincible.
Sorry, I'm invincible.
You got to London.
Yeah.
And you say that was the hardest thing I could think of. So now I'm going to do something a little easier.
Well, it was also like, you know, but also made me realize, like, you know, from a, I guess from a philosophical point of view, how much I had underestimated myself in my previous life, like in everything, from business to work to my own sporting career, in inverted commas. Like, I realized, like, I'd always underestimated myself. And now, like, as I say, this conference, like, yes, if I can do that, I can really do anything. And, so we talked about the longest haul, but fast forward a couple of years now, I'm back and living back in Hong Kong. I'd actually had a mid-adventure career break because after my longest haul, my hip that I'd originally had operation was such a mess. So I had my hip replaced. Yeah. I took up this job at Hong Kong Rugby, which is right up my alley. I sit here and really enjoy working in rugby. It seemed very serendipitous. I literally walked off the golf course of Mongolia. We flew in and out of Hong Kong. Had a couple of days there catching up with old mates and had a conversation which led to a job interview and took it. And I just thought, this is a sign. I've done one big adventure on my own. I've done one with a mate. My body is a complete wreck now. And, you know, this is just a sign that it's time to do something normal. But living in Hong Kong in 2017-18, leading up to the World Cup coming to Japan, Rugby World Cup, coming to Asia for the first time in the industry, in the sport, there was a lot of, obviously, interest in the World Cup and excitement ahead of it. And Hong Kong Rugby was supporting this program called Child Fund Rugby, which operates in Southeast Asia. And in a great stroke of genius, in my opinion, World Rugby and the Japan Rugby Union appointed Child Fund Rugby as a principal charity partner for the World Cup in Japan. So it's the first time that they had appointed a rugby program as a charity partner. It made a lot of sense. You know, the people that were benefiting from the program are in Asia. It's using the sport of rugby. And Hong Kong Rugby supported the program quite a lot as well. So I knew about the program. And then it's amazing how life works. But I was chatting to my doctor in Hong Kong, who's pretty friendly with as well. And I said, Dave, you know, I've got this idea, you know, having my, you know, I hope to place next month, going through a bit of a midlife crisis, wondering, you know, like I'm feeling a bit old all of a sudden. So I want to do one more big trip, you know, before my body completely shuts down. Do you think it would be possible to cycle from London, go back to the previous host of the World Cup, to Tokyo,
to the next one,
with a new hip? And he said, Ronnie, if you do your rehab properly, you should be golden. And then we started talking a bit more about it. And I'd actually helped one of his sons plan a trip across, well, gave him some basic advice about cycling. He planned a trip across Turkey or in China a few years before. And he said, oh, who are you going to do the trip with? I said, I haven't even got my head around doing it for myself, but I haven't really given any thought. He said, you should ask James. And I literally said, who the hell's James? And he goes, no, he's one of my sons. And I said, you know, how many kids? Anyway, it turns out James actually worked for Charlton Rugby.
Okay.
And really was quite, you know, enjoyed his, you know, he's quite jealous of his brother's cycle trip across, you know, Asia a few years before. Yeah. And he said, well, I think James would be up for it if you're looking for a partner. So I didn't think much of it, but I got this message from this Vietnam number a couple of weeks later. He says, hi, my name's James. My dad gave me a number. Anyway, I flew to Vietnam a couple of weeks after that just to go and meet the guy, have a couple of beers. And on the handshake, we said, I should see you at the start line. So that's, we knew each other for 2 days and then we cycled across the world together. But the whole, coming back to the how it came about. So I made up my mind, this is what I wanted to do. And for me, it was important to actually do it for something other than just the sake of adventure. Which is, adventure for adventure's sake is amazing. But this time I felt that I really wanted to make an impact, help support Charlton Rugby, use it for something. So I got a hold of Alan Gilpin at World Rugby, who was COO at the time.
Yeah, he was responsible for the delivery of that 2019 World Cup.
Correct, exactly. So his job was to deliver the tournament. Mm-hmm. He's a keen cyclist himself. So I met him at a coffee shop in Waterloo. I said, Alan, I've got this idea, cycling, blah, 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 as I've just mentioned. Could you organize me a replica of the trophy? Even if it's plastic, something I can take with me as a symbol of a journey, almost like the Olympic flame.
Right.
And he said, Ron, that's a really shitty idea. It's going to be bulky and it's going to be awkward.
In hindsight, yes.
Yeah, he says, but...
Here's an idea.
Yeah. We have a tradition in World Rugby. We present the referee for the opening match with a commemorative whistle to start the tournament.
Yes.
So why don't you take that for us? And that could be the symbol of the journey.
Mm.
Brilliant idea. And that tied in very well with one of their worldwide partners, which was DHL at the time.
Yeah, so you became effectively the delivery vehicle.
My best accreditation that I've ever received was at one of the hospitality in Japan.
Yeah.
Was, you know, you have Ron Rutland, and it was whistle courier. That's the best job title in the world.
Yeah.
So effectively, I got tasked with delivering the match whistle for the opening game of the tournament, which was a huge honor. Went back to Twickenham Stadium, James and I, beginning of 2nd of February, middle of winter, Twickenham Stadium. Alan presented us the whistle on the field. There's about 30 or 40 people joining us for day one. And we spent 219 days cycling. It's amazing. You can cycle from London to Tokyo, never catch a flight. There's one ferry from England to France, another short ferry across the Bosphorus in Turkey, and a final ferry from Shanghai to Osaka. Which is absolutely amazing.
Yeah, so 219 days.
Yeah, 219 days, just over 20,000 Ks.
Okay, so it's another 100 a day average.
On a kilometer per week basis, the most intense of all my trips.
Why? Because there were lots of non-riding days as well?
Oh, no, just the number of days available.
Oh, okay.
And the distance we had to cover.
Right.
So I think it averages just over 500 a week, which is basically averages to 5 days of riding a week on average. So it was pretty full on.
And how many countries there?
23 from memory. Amazing routes. I mean, we obviously leaving London in the middle of winter in February, it just worked out from the timing. We couldn't leave any earlier because I was still recovering from my hip.
Mm.
James still had some work obligations. We couldn't keep him later, though, just wouldn't have had the time. So the first month, it took us 33 days to get from London to Istanbul, which I think is about 3,000 Ks. So we really bombed that first month. I think we took 1 or 2 days off in Europe. Obviously,
The Alps?
No, we avoided all mountains. Yeah.
You couldn't anyway, maybe. A lot of them are closed.
So we just took the... obviously many freezing days. We sort of banked on being able to find accommodation every night. So we sent ahead our camping gear to lighten the load a little bit to Istanbul.
Right.
And we then cycled all the way across Turkey. And eastern Turkey, in what would have been, then been, I guess, middle of to late March, is one of the coldest. It's about 2,000 meters or so. It's similar to the steppe in Mongolia in terms of just being completely arid and dry.
Yeah.
And my goodness, my hands and feet... And I listen to podcast reviews. We've discussed exactly this. And
even with the warm gear on, you just can't get warm.
Yeah, you start sweating.
Right.
And it cools off. And then as soon as that cools off, I remember it was absolute agony. And I even, fingers, hands. And then one day, one of the other most important appendage actually also took a bit of, which was really, that's how bad it was at one stage. So, and then you sort of, in this rural, you end up in these little tiny little like petrol or gas stations. I remember very distinctly the one day sort of being taken in this, not in Western Iran. These truck drivers basically sat around like a gas stove trying to warm up. So we crossed Turkey into Iran and then into Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, and then Tajikistan. And a lot of your listeners might know the Pamir Highway. It's sort of famous overland route up through the Tajik Mountains, which is effectively the Himalayas.
In a documentary, right? Did Andrew do that one also?
Yes, he did. Everything in between. Right. So that's also available.
Everything in between. I'll put both these show links up and you can have a look at that one. There's a question I'm going to ask you about that. But I remember seeing the footage of that highway and that's the one.
Borders Afghanistan. You're bordering across the rivers of Afghanistan. You're like waving to villages in Afghanistan.
Yeah.
It's all sort of part of the old Silk Road, the hippie trail and the... so it really is a classic. I mean, it's tough riding. Mm. It's very bumpy and gravelly, but it's dramatically, dramatically beautiful. And you cycle from pretty much sea level up to about 4,500 meters.
Yeah.
Just gradually over a couple of days. And obviously, even though it's now coming to April, May, it's still pretty cold at that altitude. You then at the plateau in Tajikistan for a few days. You cross into China just for a day or two. And then you cross into Pakistan and then you drop down the Karakoram Highway. So you're dropping down from about 5,000 meters to sea level in about 2 days.
Now, this is where you've got sights of the tallest peaks in the world. Yeah. There's 8,000 on either side.
I'm getting goosebumps to talk to you about it. Yeah. And it was peak climbing season, peak trekking season then. So it's early May, I think it was, off the top of my head.
Yeah.
I think down that Karakoram Highway, that they call it, three or four of the 8,000 meter peaks.
You just see them.
You can see them. They've got signboards, and you can see why the mountains call people. It is just
spiritual.
It's spiritual. Mm. It's like I'm not a religious person anyway, but that literally takes your breath away. Mm. It's just, and then you drop down and sort of into the Islamabad and Lahore and that, and it's like midsummer. So you're going from 5,000 meters. Hovering around zero to dropping down to, and then it's now you're in peak heat season in Southeast Asia. So it was in Pakistan, into India, up into Nepal, back into India, across Myanmar, a couple of days in Thailand, Laos, Vietnam, southern China, into Hong Kong, back into China, and then across to Japan.
Let's stay on the altitude now, because 5,000 meters is high.
Yeah, yeah.
Most people who land in, let's say, if you're in the United States, Denver, that's a mile high, 1,600. Johannesburg's at around 2,000 at its highest points. Mm. Mexico City, 2,000. Most people would feel that.
Yeah.
What's it like cycling from sea level to 5,000 in 2 days? Because that's more aggressive than when you walk Kili.
Yeah, so it was probably near a 3 day. The Pamir Highway in that journey, it probably took us near a week. But the journey I've just done cycling through the Andes, very similar heights. So in the Himalayas, it was probably just around 5 miles exactly. You've got the two of the highest paved road border crossings in the world between Tajikistan and China and China and Pakistan. That was cool. And then, but this journey now cycling into Bolivia, you cycle across Paraguay, which is it could not be any flatter country in the world. and then you cycle up the Andes, and that was about 2.5 days of climbing from sea level pretty much to just over 5,000 meters. But it's amazing. Like I've never done Kili, but it didn't affect me really in any way. I think it was slow enough still. I believe obviously it was because I was fine to adapt as I went.
Yeah.
The only time I noticed anything was, and it similarly happened in the Himalayas, was sleeping. Sometimes I'd wake up and just gasping for a bit like.
Because you underbreathe and then all of a sudden the carbon dioxide falls up and oxygen falls, and then you have to take a gasp.
Yeah, because I'm like cycling at such a low intensity, and again, I think we spoke about this last night, like must be zone one and two 90% of the time. That sort of level of intensity, you're not really out of breath ever.
Mm.
So you just sort of go in your sort of low gear and you just mosey up in a slow enough pace. And and then this journey now that I've just done is amazing. I was up at the sort of between probably 3.8 and 5,000 meters for about 6 or 7 weeks, which is pretty extraordinary. It's the most beautiful. I mean, I want to take a bike back there and just go and explore
these different places.
Unbelievable, Ross. So you're adapting. I listened to your episode recently on altitude, and I had so many comments I had to make. And then the best descent of my life was coming off the Andes, the other side. I've never had the most perfect profile for descending on a 40-50 kilogram touring bike. I'm a big guy still, and descending down, you basically don't touch your brakes or pedals. I think I did that. I'll find the Strava day, but I probably did it. I want to say probably in 2 hours. It was almost without a bump, dropping from like probably 3,500-4,000 down to sea level. To come back to it, when I started, then now I'm cycling sea level. I didn't notice any difference red blood cells or whatever that thing that makes. I must say, it just felt completely the same as I had been before I'd done that whole altitude.
Right.
Time and amounts of
it. Yeah, that'll be intensity related. I'm sure if you needed it, you would have had something more than before you did the
little altitude. But that's just
What was the hardest climb you ever did on this ride, would you say, objectively and subjectively?
The hardest
single climb.
I know you're a stats guy. I don't have all those to hand, but I would just there's some really short, sharp. It's very, very, very rare I've had to push my bike. But in Japan, of all places, we've got the app that I use for routing, for planning these trips is pretty good. It's not perfect. And you get a pretty good idea of the profile ahead. But there was one day in particular, it was about a 1.5 kilometer distance climb. It was too heavy. It was too steep to ride. So you're pushing, and to push a 40, 50 kilogram bike uphill.
That's hard.
It's really, really hard. Yeah. So that probably took me an hour or so. I can't remember that, but it was just... And that springs to mind straight away. There was a time in Laos. It was about a 2-3 kilometer climb, and then it was partly. It's the middle of the monsoon season, so the roads are terrible as in the best of times. Yeah. So it's partly just because the traction is so bad.
Yes.
And that took a couple of hours as well, pushing this bike up this gravel road. Roads washed away.
And the longest continuous ascent was 100K or something.
Yeah, I'd say. I must go back and check. But climbing up the Andes this year, climbing. Yeah.
And you climb 5,000 meters.
Yeah.
5% for 100K, folks.
Yeah. There you go. That's the thing. And it obviously fluctuates as you're going, but that's the average.
Tell us about the mudslide.
Yeah, so going back to things that almost killed me.
That was on the Tokyo trip. That was the first whistle delivery.
Delivery. It was all going very well, actually, despite some of this, the frostbite and things like that. But we're in now Laos in the middle of the wet season, and Laos is this landlocked country between Vietnam, China, Thailand. It's an incredibly beautiful place. Very, very... it's very little infrastructure. It's the most bombed country in the world. So during the Vietnam War, it got absolutely hammered. Sort of the Americans were basically trying to... this trail that the Vietnamese were using to sort of smuggle arms and people. And they kind of went through Laos. It's a long story. But so infrastructure is not very good at all. They're in the wet season. And... I had to get across the type of visa that I had. I had to cross into Vietnam on a particular day because we were there on official business, in inverted commas, for child fund. We got some sort of visa, which meant on my South African passport, I had to cross in on that day. James was on his British passport, and he had a slightly different visa. You could cross anytime. So I was bent out, and the roads were so bad. Roads were washed away. There was trucks in the river. It really was horrific. You see people's houses being washed away. Some of the wildest conditions I've ridden in, but I'm so stubborn, and I just had a goal, and I had to get to that.
So if you hadn't crossed that day, denied access, then what would have happened?
Well, then I would have been stuck and had to try and somehow this remote border town organize a visa.
Okay, so the stakes are pretty high.
So
you're going for it.
So I'm going for it, and the weather conditions are atrocious, and I've pushed my bike through a few landslides and mudslides that are already in, up to maybe knee deep, which is pretty tough going, pushing a bike through that sort of mud. There's trucks stuck there. It's really not well. And then the day is taking much longer than planned just because the conditions are so tough. And I get to what's probably now about 2 km from the border, top of a hill. about must be 60, 70 meters above this raging river. And I can, and I know that the border post is at the bottom of this hill. And I get there, and there's this mudslide in front of me. And I actually took my GoPro out, and I said, yo, you can make a documentary out of this, but I've now got to work my way across this. Put the GoPro in. And if you can imagine, the river and the cliff is on my left. The right-hand side is the mountain. So it's this road that's cut into the mountain.
There's footage of this, by the way, in the documentary. I'm not imagining, I'm remembering. Yeah, but so listeners, go and watch this.
It's a relatively narrow two-lane road. I mean, lanes, there's no lines or anything, but it's just this road. So all this mud has now fallen off the mountain. So obviously the closer you are to the mountain, the thicker the mud is. And it sort of gets thinner as it goes towards the cliff where it's washing over the edge. So I'm looking at this and it's, you know, if you drop over there, you're dead. I mean, it's a massively high drop. There's no, like, ifs and buts about it. So I'm trying to work out where to, further right I go towards the mountain, is the thicker the mud. And I mean, it's up to chest deep. That's how deep it is, to the edge where it's basically ankle deep. So I sort of choose a line, watch the mud for a while to make sure it's not moving anymore. You know, it's like a period of, you know, it's very, very thick. So it's like a slow, sludgy.
Yeah.
So I go in at a sort of level about knee deep again. And it's slow work. You sort of, you know, you walk, you sort of push your bike, walk, you know, you sort of almost like lift, so you're lifting your bike, or lift your bike, and then all of a sudden there's a surge of mud, and I get,
I'm
heading towards the cliff, so, and now I'm out, obviously blind panic, so I just abandon the bike, because I just thought, you know, I've got to save myself, and I'm kind of swimming, or imagine trying to swim up towards the bank to get away from the edge, but obviously as the further towards, the thicker it gets, and I'm now like chest deep in this mud. And it's like it's almost like it's so heavy and it's full of rocks and debris, and you're trying to pull yourself out of this and trying to, like,
terrifying. Just listening to it,
I can't. It's just rocky. And and I'm here today to tell you I made it.
The bike's gone.
No, and then fortunately the bike, that surge stopped.
Yeah,
but I made my way across because this is not halfway. So it was. Well, just past us. The shortest exit was the other side.
Yeah.
So I get to the other side. But while this is happening, James and we had a couple of people riding, supporting the charity. We're riding with James. So by this stage, it's taken so long. James had caught up with another guy, and they could see my bike, but it's loud. It's raining, and I can see them sort of trying to. And I'm going, oh, no, because save myself. Just told them don't come because they don't know what's just happened.
Yeah.
So I get to the other side, and then they walk nonchalantly. Closer to, like, they see my bike. They tie themselves to each other with some bungees that they had,
which could go very badly wrong.
Yeah, I don't think they quite realized. they just thought it was probably sedentary. Yeah. So they walk. Those two pick my bike. It gets to the other side. Then I tell them what happened, and then they just go white. And now the three of us are stuck on that side of the mud. Their bike's the other side. We've got only got my gear, which now obviously is covered. Most of these things are covered in mud. We've got one passport between us. And they're obviously not going to risk going back to get their bike. So we then walk down the hill to this, to the border post, which is now closed. This is far too late. But James, fortunately, because he had lived in Laos, speaks fluent Lao. So he started chatting to some officials that were, and it's a very remote place. So he explained the situation. I pulled my passport out, which is, you know, so it's the Vietnam side was the side to be worried about, not leaving Laos. You know, I can leave any day. But I pulled it out. James explained the situation. And they were incredibly helpful. They got hold of their colleagues, I guess, on the Vietnamese side. And there was a lot of backpackers and forwards. And it turns out the Vietnamese police there, water guards, had like a barracks. It was very, very informal.
So they
let us stay at the border post. Now, James went to go. They let him walk into the nearest town. It's just, I don't know, a few hundred meters other side of on the Vietnam side.
Yeah.
I think we bought about a case of beers. And just sat in this room and decompress.
And then what? They went back a day or two later to get the bikes?
So, yeah. So then, yeah. And obviously, it was unpacked that whole. I mean, I still get goosebumps thinking about it.
It's incredible.
And so we just, we shared the dryish clothes that were still in my bags that we could. And just slept in this room. And then the next morning, I had to... So Vietnam, they basically, at the end of the day, they were flexible. They understood the situation, let me in anyway. I had another friend joining me in the next town, so I sort of went on my own. And then James and this guy called Doc, they walked back up the hill. And by then, it'd been partially cleared, and they walked across. And then there's other people there. You know, it wasn't just those two who didn't have any, who had no idea what it all transpired. And But that vision, Ross, as that surge hits, I remember so, like, there's obviously that natural instinct of trying to save yourself,
yes.
But it was almost serene. Like, I remember so distinctively going, this is sad. It wasn't like a fear. It was like, isn't this sad? Like, we've been through so much. this is how it's going to end. And I hope James finishes this. I remember so...
Yeah.
And I was just like... And also, this is going to cause so much problems because no one's going to know. There's going to be no bike there. There's going to be no sign that I was there.
Yeah, you won't know where's
no one. No one's going to have any idea what happened to me.
And you thought all that in that moment.
It's just, yeah. It's
amazing how fast your brain processes possibilities and scenarios.
I guess it's, in a good way, it's like, it wasn't like, there was no fear of dying. It wasn't like the death didn't fear me. The fall wasn't like, I'm sure it's going to be horrible. But like, it wasn't like, there was no like, oh my God. It was just sadness. But I guess it's also like, I don't know if there's any truth to it, but sort of, I guess it was elements of like, you know, it's a much better way to go than if I was, you know, died in a car accident on the way to a job that I hated or something, you know. it's been the most wild last few years. Yeah. And I didn't think this deeply at the time about this, but in hindsight, you think it's like, you're putting yourself in these risky situations and you're putting, as you talked about before, I mean, you know, we want to sum up some stats. I've probably done just over 100,000 kilometers now in the last 10 years on these journeys. And just the odds are at some stage.
Right.
I mean, I don't know what the actual stats are out there.
You've obviously had a lot of time on your own cycling, and you must have had considerable time to think about the philosophy of life and the meaning of everything. Must have changed your perspective on things quite a lot in the last 10 years, eh?
Oh. Yeah, more than you can imagine, Ross. So it's just, I absolutely just love the simplicity of life on the road. Mm. Everything you own, everything you need is in a couple of bags and panniers on the back of your bike. The joy that I've experienced the last 10 years of the people I've met, it's honestly that money can't buy it. Mm. Even if you won the lottery, you wouldn't be able to have those experiences. It really, really is just, yeah, I just feel like there's nothing in my life that I could imagine being more rewarding than the last 10 years. And, you know, I'm putting a hard stake in the ground after this journey. And I made that decision, you know, after I recovered in Mexico and was feeling good again. I just said, you know what, thinking about things, every time I finished my journeys before, I've never had any certainty. It's always been like, everyone's next question is what's next, and now it's like, it's been very liberating having made the decision now that this is it from that point of view. So at that stage of my life, that guy I had left 10 years ago, if I could interview him now and said, how do you think your life will turn out, it would I can't imagine, you know. It's inconceivable, right?
Like, you can't imagine it. And that's why I've also always had this idea that people say you should have a 5-year plan and a 10-year plan. And I've always thought, I never had that for my life.
And
if you'd asked me 5 years ago, where would I be? I couldn't have imagined where I would be.
And sometimes maybe you're shutting off so many doors and so many opportunities.
Because now you've picked the path you're going to walk, and it means you don't, because by definition, you've chosen.
And you're shutting on every other path.
You've chosen every other one, right? There are some people, though, who need that structure in their life. So we are getting somewhat philosophical here now. But you started that first ride in Africa having planned one day.
Yeah.
But you still had a vision for what it was going to take and how long it was going to take and how you needed to structure it overall. But the specifics were open.
The huge amount of planning went into it. The biggest thing was around visas. How I was going to organize visas.
Logistics.
I mean, obviously, you know, there's a lot of, you know, you always overthink these things, but the equipment you need, the clothing you need.
To the day, in the case of Vietnam, you just told us a story. That was literally had to be planned to the day.
There's a lot of specifics. You do make commitment, and then you make, you know, this is a fundraiser, you make commitments to people along the way. Let's do a fundraising dinner in New York on that date, or, you know, just cycled 300 Ks with 180 people from Twickenham. You know, couldn't be late for that, for example.
Because, you know, on this podcast, we interviewed a guy called Richie, who was a Marine.
Yes, I do remember.
He said one of the things they teach them deliberately is to never be flexible and to always be comfortable with sudden changes in the plan. And so they'll deliberately expose them to situations where they'll tell them one thing and everyone creates an expectation, and they'll do something unplanned and surprising,
yeah,
because they want to disrupt your ability to be comfortable.
Yeah.
You've basically imposed that on yourself.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
For 10 years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's yeah, yeah, yeah. And it's, yeah, so you have a, yeah, yeah, we are getting philosophical, but yeah, it's a, yeah, sort of have, I mean, yeah, I've got a start point, I've got an end point, and I put as much, I've planned and controlled as much as I can. Mm. And then you just have to, yeah, then it's just about adapting as you go. And there was curveball after curveball, yeah, after curveball.
Because you know David Epstein, you know,
yes,
the name.
Yes, yeah.
He writes a newsletter, and in fact, yesterday his newsletter was on this exact thing, and he spoke about the World Athletics Champs and how the athletes go to these big championships like the World Athletics Champs and the Olympics, and they're often thrown by the fact that they've got a plan that then can't be realized, and they fail because of their own expectations.
So give me an example.
Well, in this piece, he talks about the sprinter from England called Dina Asher-Smith. And okay. She talks about how, you know, in England they call Sod's Law, whatever can go wrong will go wrong.
Yeah.
And if you go in there with a fixed mindset about how things are going to be, you are pretty much permanently going to be frustrated and anxious and panicking. And then you're going to find yourself stuck in a warm-up area for longer than you thought. Yeah. You're going to be in a holding room for longer than you thought. And everything's disrupted. And your ability to be agile in your actions within an overall principle of performance was the point he was making.
Yes.
And I think that's what you learn.
I guess it's like, it's, you know, if you're a golfer and you know your tee time and you know what time you want to arrive at the golf course to, you know, in a major championship, whatever, and there's traffic and you get stuck and all of a sudden you arrive at the golf course and your whole warm-up routine's gone out the window.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I mean, I think it's such a true thing for anything in life, you know,
yeah,
whether
exactly.
it's either you're running a business or even if you're a school teacher or whatever you're doing in life. You know, if you can't adapt to sudden surprises or sudden change, well, it's a very anxious way to live, basically.
And anyways, they always say to athletes, control the controllables.
Yeah. I have.
But like sometimes athletes wrongly identify what's controllable.
So I've actually been doing a lot of reading and listening. So the one thing I've been reading a lot about is stoicism on this trip as well. And that's what exactly, all comes down to.
Yeah.
That really is just kind of like, you can't control the weather. You control the clothes you've got.
Yes.
Basically. And and it's I guess even consciously or subconsciously, that's become the way I've lived my life for the last 10 years. And that's why, Ross, like I've just turned 49. If I was 49 years of age with no house, no job, no prospects, no, you know, money or wealth or whatever, and I hadn't had these last 10 years. So if I was in this situation and hadn't had these previous 10 years of my life, I think I'd be in a pretty dark place.
Yeah.
But I'm so excited for what lies ahead. And part of that is because I have no idea what it's going to be.
Right.
I know what it's not going to be is spending years cycling around the world.
A lot of people listening to this would not have an idea of what's coming next, and they wouldn't be excited. They'd be terrified and anxious.
But I think, so can we talk stats quickly?
Yeah, please. Well,
okay, no. So I'll just to sum it up, like, so the last 10 years, 100,000 kilometers, about, I haven't done the final numbers, somewhere around 112, 115 countries, and it's all six continents. Okay, sorry, Antarctica, they'll get there for a trip one day. But all six, you know, proper continents.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've met, I don't know how many tens of thousands of people, and there is just, like, basically it's just showing me what is possible in terms of, like, the way people live their lives, the jobs that they do, the careers that they've got, the businesses they've run. And it's just like this next period of my life, I want to do something different. I want to do something and it's exciting to know that there's something. Maybe I want to become a teacher. I'm going to become a teacher or become a plumber or, you know, something. It sounds random, but what an opportunity to be able to start life with a clean slate and to do something that I haven't yet found, you know, I haven't yet discovered. And you know, if it's half as good as the last 10 years, that's an exciting adventure in its own right.
Yeah. I don't want to not cover the other two cycling trips.
Okay.
Because it's almost like this would be an appropriate place to end, but I can't because we're only halfway.
Okay. I'll give you the short version.
No. Let's talk about it. So you deliver the whistle in Tokyo.
Yeah, deliver the whistle in Tokyo.
We win that tournament.
So yeah, so it ended a bit better.
It's a solid.
Yeah.
After the previous one.
Yeah.
And then your next one is Tokyo to New Zealand.
Yeah.
That's where the Women's World Cup's going to happen. But was that inevitable? Did you know that was going to happen as you were heading into Tokyo, or did it come up afterwards? Because COVID obviously messed that plan up if it was made.
Yep. So I got to arrived in Tokyo. James and I arrived there. We presented the whistle to Nigel Owens, who's ref the massive opening game between Russia and Japan. Yeah. And did a bit of whistle. We raised about $135,000 for child fund rugby. So, I mean, it was, from my point of view, an incredible success. So, I dreamt up this, you know, and there's a sense of satisfaction. You put this big project together, you got this time, there's more stakeholders and sponsors involved. We pulled it off, survived. I picked up survived the landslide, and I picked up this illness. It's called Wheels disease, or Wheels, it comes from rat's wee, so it's not the most, anyway, nice. So I got pretty sick and got through that, and, we can probably talk about that as well, but anyway, I got to Tokyo and it was like, okay, we've pulled off something pretty special here. So I guess I hadn't made any decisions at that stage about whether I was going to do it again or whether I'd have the appetite to do it again. But during that tournament, somebody kindly offered us, sponsored us at the Cape Epic Entry. Absolutely, Cape Epic, a big mountain bike race in South Africa, we all know about. And James had never been, my riding partner, never been to South Africa. He had never heard of the race. But I said to him, this is a valuable ticket, not just financially, but they're hard to get. Why don't you and I, let's go and do this race. And let's come and spend some time in South Africa. I actually rent a little cottage in the Natal Midlands, a place called Nottingham Roads. I love that part of the world. Rent a little cottage. And I kind of used him as an excuse to get around the country. Also just to catch up with mates of mine, see what was going on the ground, see if something came up. While we entered a couple of races. And then, obviously, as we know, COVID suddenly landed on our doorstep. The race was cancelled like 36 hours notice. So I ended up in that cottage in the Midlands for 2 years. So it was the best place to see out COVID. I was on a little small holding. So I had, my garden was a forest. So it was like, I could ride my bike and go for walks and things. But anyway, and then during that period, obviously, you start. And I had a really good 2020 look ahead of me. You know, in terms of, I had a lot of corporate speaking stuff on the cards. So it was looking like a good year from that point of view. And obviously all that evaporated overnight and did one or two Zoom talks and things like that. And I think, you know, it's probably not the same. You can't charge the same either. So anyway, I had a lot of time to think of different projects.
Yeah.
I tried to put together one project optimistically in 2021 to cycle from the lowest point in Africa to the highest.
It's Eritrea or Ethiopia?
Djibouti. It's a place called Lake of Salt.
Eastern Horn there. I remember that bit. And then up to Kili.
To the top of Kili. So that's a project on. That's the sort of project I might do in the future. You know, you could probably do it in 30 days. It'd be a nice little short-term thing. But anyway, and then I started chatting to World Rugby and just talk about it. And then my initial idea was to do the two continents that were missing with Americas on my sort of cycling CV, if you want, and Oceania. So I started plotting a route from Japan down to New Zealand, then across to South America, up South America, across
which
to...
Which you then got to do in two World Cup trips.
And then the Women's World Cup, but delayed by a thing. Child Fund with the official charity of the Women's World Cup. DHL, one of the sponsors of that tournament. So kind of a cookie, you know, cut and paste what we did in 2019. And then I wrote to a different guy, and the two of us cycled, went back to Tokyo. I mean, this was... And Japan was very conservative with reopening. So this was March 2022.
We basically got the first visas,
and then the World Cup in September.
So
Adam and I cycled from Japan. It was a bit disrupted. We couldn't get into China because of COVID, so we had to fly to Vietnam. Cycled Vietnam, Cambodia, Thailand, Malaysia, into Singapore, and island hopped Indonesia all the way to East Timor. Hopped across to Darwin. Spent about 6 or 7 weeks cycling from Darwin to Sydney, across the outback, then along the coast. Pretty amazing. Up the length, New Zealand. For the women's Rugby World Cup, which was an unbelievable tournament.
Yeah, it seems the way they've put it together, the triple headers and so on.
The triple headers, and the way that the New Zealand public got behind it, the atmosphere, some of the rugby was at the top games was absolutely fantastic. I watched the World Cup final, England, New Zealand, firm favourites. And there was a lot of discussion with some really heavyweight rugby people in the hospitality suite that evening after the game. Admittedly, in the midst of the excitement of it all, about whether that was actually the best World Cup final ever.
From
a rugby point of view.
Basically decided on a line-out steal 5 metres from the line with time gone.
Exactly right, yeah. So it had everything. It had all the drama. It was end-to-end, a lot of tries. And then got presented the whistle for the opening game of 2023 World Cup, which is tonight.
And you left literally like the day after.
Yep, the final was on a Saturday. I left a Sunday.
Yeah.
Cycled to the airport, flew to Santiago, Chile. You want to talk about amazing rides, and then cycled straight up over the Andes. So you fly, you come out of Santiago, camped one night. Second day, you start climbing. And then the third day, you go up this road. I think it's like 35 switchbacks. They actually number them. And you look up ahead of you, and it's just this wall of mountain. And you can see the switchback. You can see the trucks sort of snaking their way up the mountain. Wow. So that's, if you want to talk about just, it's only, I mean, only goes up to about 3,000 meters, but it's just absolutely beautiful. I mean, it's a beautifully paved road. It's got to be one of the most iconic road cycles you can possibly imagine. And you drop down the other side to Mendoza. And so across Argentina, into Uruguay. So the first four countries of this trip were all participating nations of the World Cup. So New Zealand, Chile, Argentina, Uruguay, Chile playing their first World Cup.
That's right.
Their qualification means for the first time ever there's no North American representation in the tournament. And then made my way through Central America into the US, up the East Coast to New York, then flew to Dublin, and then to go and see all the rugby cities, the five participating nations.
Yes.
So Dublin to Edinburgh, down to Cardiff. Well, I was lucky enough to arrive on the day South Africa played Wales. Timed that nicely. Nice. A couple of weeks ago as a warm-up.
Oh, that was the warm-up fixture. That's right, yeah.
Then I cycled up to rugby. That's the 200th anniversary of the sport, so I thought it would be appropriate to go and visit the place where it started.
Okay, it's all fallen into place, huh?
Yeah, and then I finished a day and a half later, arrived at Twickenham on the Thursday, and Friday we played the All Blacks in what has turned out to be All Blacks' biggest defeat ever. So, in a rugby field. So that was a...
And I hope your streak continues. And that wasn't the peak of it.
Yeah, exactly. Well,
that would be the concern, is once you play that well, where do you go from there?
Well, that is my concern. And I'm trying not to jump on the bandwagon that we're not favourites. So I want to go in as...
I'd rather be nervous than hopeful.
Yeah, exactly. So we got to get past Scotland on Sunday. But anyway, and then spent 10 days in London, basically putting the final pieces together for... We had 100, can you believe, 180 people. The RFU let us into Twickenham, to part of the Twickenham Stadium. And for a lot of people, it's the hardest thing they've ever done in their life. And there's the amount of grit and determination that you see from people. It's pretty inspiring. And then we got to cycle into Paris yesterday, under sort of fully supported police escort through the streets of Paris, which I think only happens the Tour de France.
Yeah, twice a year maybe. The women do it and the men.
Yeah, and I think there's, and Hot Chili, who organised the event, they've somehow got these connections. They do another London to Paris once a year. So it's very, very massive privilege. And, obviously I enjoy my cycling. And I still get, it's weird, I still get it. When people say, oh, this is Ron, he's a cyclist, I still find it hot. I still think of myself as a, I still think of myself as a rugby player who cycles.
Right.
Like cyclists, I took rugby seriously, and cycling is basically anything I can do now. So I just enjoy, so it's weird. Like, but I am a keen fan of the cycling and the sport. Mm. But so we arrived at, Paris last night. So I lost my train of thought. I apologize.
No, it's all good. It's all good. So have I to some extent. In these four trips then, where in that sequence were you at your fittest, do you think? What was the physical pinnacle that you've reached in the last decade?
I would say, so I spoke earlier about that month I took off, or 4 weeks I took from Mexico City. I would say a week or two after that, and despite being 10 years older than when I started, I mean, and also there's the recency effect of remembering this most recently. I was in Texas. It's blisteringly hot. June. And there's some sort of heat dome they talked about, and it was like all these weather warnings. I mean, it's just furnace-like conditions. But I don't think I've ever felt, I can't remember anyway, ever feeling stronger on a bike.
It's interesting that it took that layoff.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because that would suggest to me that you're probably overtrained for about 5 years.
Yeah.
Because the first trip you started, as you said, completely unfit because of a wrist injury that kept you from training. The second trip you would have started relatively unfit because of a hip replacement.
Yeah, I was very, very unfit, yeah.
Third trip maybe down to New Zealand, COVID, maybe you were moderately trained.
Yeah, I was ticking over.
This last one you would have started in New Zealand fairly strong.
Yes, I had a month off the World Cup, so there was certainly no calorie deficit for that month.
And then... Yeah, so it's almost like that idea that you load the system so much, but it's not until you recover that you realize the benefits of that load. And you needed that recovery in Mexico, and then suddenly you realized all that accrued gain.
I must say, it's interesting you said, now you think about, you've prompted me to think, I must say that first few weeks in South America, I was also feeling really good.
Off New Zealand. It's because you've got such a base. I mean, I don't know if there'd be a human being with a base you've got.
Yeah.
right now.
Yeah, probably, yeah.
You know what I mean? And then a bit of a recovery and a break, and then you just got to reload that system, and now you...
But it's interesting. I mean, I'd ask you, like, so, yeah, somehow I've pretty much got a really exceptional base at the moment, but it obviously depends how you define fitness. But if I try to go and do a pull-up now, I wouldn't be able to do one pull-up.
Yeah, sure, sure.
And, you know, if you told me to go and play a game of touch rugby, I'm sure I'd pull a hammy or I'd be out of breath within seconds, or play a game of squash or something. So, I guess, but from a base point of view, from an endurance point of view, I want to go do the manga next week or something, you know, something like that, you know.
Yeah. Because you're basically physiologically, you've proven yourself to be physiologically unstoppable at the right intensity.
Yeah.
You can just go and go and go.
I mean, I think that, for example, that 33 days we did across Europe, I mean, I'm looking at the stats, but it's pretty rare that I would do 2 weeks without a day off. Statistically. But I feel that, I feel like I could ride every day, 100 Ks, you know, at that sort of intensity. I can't, you know, without needing a break. I'm sure there'd be a time that you would break down.
Eventually, but you hadn't reached that point yet. Although maybe you did towards this last one when you got to Costa Rica. You know, you might have been so suppressed, immune function down, just tired. But I think there must be a lot of mental fatigue as well.
Yeah, and there are this trip particular, because didn't have a sponsor for this last leg.
Yeah.
My riding partner, Adam, who was rode with me from London to Japan, Japan to New Zealand, he was supposed to ride this leg, but without a sponsor, it wasn't possible for him. So I was kind of throwing that curveball and now being on my own. Without a sponsor, you know, there's a fundraising, which was all, I was all stacked, and I was putting all my cards in this last 180-day ride. So I was pretty much, like, in the middle of South America, there was times I was going, like, this is unbelievable. Like, no one cares. Like, it's just... it's not that it's just like sometimes you go like, why am I beating myself, why am I just pushing so hard? But no one, like, if I jumped on a train tomorrow, no one cares. I think it was a bit of frustration at the situation, financial stress. It was like a little thing. So there's that sort of challenge. But that too will pass.
Right, and that's because
I know all the times I've had when I've had slumps and I've been, but you know, been unwell, or and the highs, you know, you're on a high and then, you know, there's times when you beautiful day, the next thing, an unexpected rainstorm comes and you're drenched, you're cold, but you know what, you wake up the next day and eventually you dry out and eventually have another good day. So so mental fatigue, it's, and this trip now, I've been planning, it's just 180 people, I've basically put that whole thing together from the back of my bike over the last year. It's pretty exhausting itself.
And so you've already centered at what you'll do next, which is nothing. But that's probably not going to be the case. But what about, you thought about doing guided trips?
So this is,
would you want to do that? So, do you think it would take away the appeal for you? Responsible for other people?
Well, the last 3 days has been exactly that. I've effectively guided 180 people, and it is mentally exhausting. It is, especially a group that size. But somebody said to me yesterday, they have not seen so much laughter for a 3-day period ever, basically. And so just being surrounded by people that are doing something that's out of their comfort zone for most people, and that shared spirit, that shared camaraderie, it is worth it for me. Like, despite all the stresses that it causes, and I'm really a perfectionist wanting to make sure everything's perfect, so I get annoyed when things don't work out.
So here's a thought. If I said, okay, we're going to do a Science of Sport guided tour with Ron Rutland through, because you sold it to me last night and today, South America.
Yeah.
And it was going to be 21 days. And you said to you, like, you'd put a package together and you'd say, okay, we're going to cap it at 15 people.
Yeah.
To make it logistically manageable for you.
Yeah.
Is that the kind of thing you would then entertain?
Oh, yeah, 100%. Yeah.
That would be cool, eh?
Yeah, that would be very cool.
Yeah.
Are we planting seeds here?
Yeah, I'm definitely, like...
Well, I think, well...
It would be the first time I've planted a seed and then failed to water it, because I have more ideas than I have time.
I've got an ideas folder on my laptop, which is you couldn't do all those in three lifetimes.
Even Africa. You said to me Uganda and Burundi. Was it Burundi or Rwanda? You said Rwanda. Unbelievable.
Yeah. We'll put this out there as well. Like, I think Africa lowest to highest. It hasn't been done on a bicycle. It hasn't been done. I don't think any form. So that would take probably 30 days. Probably be the ideal number would be around 15, 16 people. And 3,000 Ks or so of cycling from out of from Djibouti through Ethiopia, length of Kenya and across the border. And up is a, as you know now, people do cycle up Kili, so that that's possible. And you have a glorious...
How can you get up Kili on a bike?
Up to, okay, I
mean, like without pushing it.
Up to the last day, then it's hike a bike to the top.
Yes, yeah, because that's my altitude experience. And we were doing like 2Ks an hour walking.
Yes, walk, yeah.
I couldn't believe it. I remember one time I was at the sort of, I was in the group and we were on the last stretch from the base camp up to the lip. And I had to go off for a little bathroom break. And so I lost, over those 2 minutes, I lost about 50 meters. Because you're literally going 20 meters a minute. It's unbelievable. You couldn't walk that slowly if you tried.
Yeah, yeah.
And then to catch up, I had to walk a little faster for 2 minutes. I got to the back of the peloton, as it were.
Yeah.
And I felt like I'd done an 800 meter race. I was absolutely gassed. It took me about 45 minutes to recover.
See, I find that it's so weird, Ross. I haven't done Kili. And that sounds like the experience of, that's everyone's experience. Mm. So it still doesn't compute to me, like the cycling up like the Andes. Really, like it's the same altitude. It's the same.
And that's why I wish we'd measured it. Because when I did Kili with the guys, and you know all the guys.
Yeah.
One of my things was we measured oxygen saturations, the finger or the earlobe, with the finger. And you could predict after 3 days out of five climbing who was struggling and who wasn't because...
Based on that?
Yeah, because it drops overnight and then you know that person's going to be in trouble because...
What does it drop down to? Do
you remember? You know Headley?
Yes.
Yeah, Headley, that Matterons and mine now. He got into the low 70s, waking up. Now, most people would finish the day's walking, say like the sort of 7-8 hours, you'd get to base camp, we do that assessment at night. Most people would be, let's say, 80-something, but by the next...
Do you want to interrupt? I just want to say goodbye to the legend.
No, don't apologize. We're just... One of Ron's fans has just come over to say how's it? No, no worries.
And great friends. Yeah. Thanks for seeing that about it.
He's got another Kiwi fan here. It's a problem with being with a celebrity. What was I saying? Yeah, so we'd measure the sats as we got to camp, and yeah, most of the time they dropped into the low 80s.
Okay.
But then most people overnight would get back into the low 90s.
So what are we at the moment, would you say?
98, 99. Okay, yeah, you'd be worried if you weren't.
Okay.
And then as you go higher and higher, obviously the next morning it's going to be lower. But most people were, even at base camp, they were in the low 80s. But
when Headley, you start getting worried?
Yeah, Headley's, the moment it's not recovering overnight.
Okay, yeah.
And that's that thing that you said where some people just don't have the sensitivity to altitude enough to hyperventilate.
Okay, yeah.
And then they don't breathe enough, and that's why they drop overnight.
Oh, right.
And you say, okay, we've got to keep an eye on that because that's actually trending in the wrong direction.
Oh, right.
And sure enough, when we got to the everyone made it. He made it. But of the group, he was the one who was affected the most by it. And you could predict it 3 days before. It's really interesting.
That's amazing. Yeah, it really is interesting. And it just shows it. It's not... There's no correlation to fitness. There's no, like, as you would traditionally think, you know, old heavy smokers who don't have a problem and you feel...
And that's why it would be so interesting. And that's why if we did ever water the seed that I planted about going to South America or even the slowest or highest African one, you'd say to those 15 people, one of the deals is you're going to be research participants in a study. And we're actually going to call this a study in how you adapt. Like, for instance, it would be fascinating to me to measure your mitochondrial mass. Because that's the little guy in the cell that contains all those enzymes that produce energy for you. And we know that one of the adaptations in endurance athletes is more mitochondria. Imagine Ron Ratland on day zero of that trip in 2013 compared to Ron Ratland in Texas in 2023.
Yeah.
That comparison, a 10-year evolution of a...
Even though you've aged 10 years, there's a natural decline.
Yeah, so what's happening there? And between trips, how much does it return to baseline, or do you get some sort of like resilience in that and... easier to get it back when you restart. All those things, fascinating, right? But yeah, I wish I'd had oxygen sats on you in there, Andy. Yeah. It could have been really fascinating. A couple of quick fire questions, because you've been more than generous with your time, and I've been more than greedy with it.
No.
How many punctures did you have?
Dozens. Well, on the last, this is let's just look
not
at
hundreds,
the last.
Not hundreds?
Over the 10 years, hundreds, but I'd say the last, this last, if we look at the last year, dozens. Yeah.
And when you have a mechanical, like a bike covered in mud, what was the procedure to replace parts and so on? Is that difficult?
It so depends where you are. And, I've always got... I'm giving you a non-straightforward answer. I'm not a mechanically minded person, but I just always... You always make a plan. Like, I've got spare brake pads, I've got...
There are people who won't get through Epic with a bit of mud in the derailleur and they're done.
Yeah. I've just taught myself over the years. Okay. I've solved most problems.
Right.
I've never not been able to get to... I mean, times in Africa, you get to some bush mechanic and he pulls out a hammer and a chisel and he starts bashing away on things. Right. So I've always managed to make temporary fixes at least. Yeah.
Okay, fair enough. I had another question I was going to ask you, but I don't remember it now. Perhaps that's a good time to.
I think South Africa is going to within a good chance of winning, but I'm not. So that was the question.
It might have been.
Yeah.
It may have been indeed. Yeah. Listen, Ron, it's been much longer than I think you even bargained for, but that's because, and we haven't touched the surface.
I feel like we could carry on.
We definitely could, but I'm not going to put that on you. I know you're going to the game tonight.
Can't wait. 80,000 people Stade de France.
I can't wait for that anthem.
Yeah, me neither. And I can't wait to see the reaction to the haka as well from the fans. Yes. That's going to be pretty special. I think they're going to sing.
They don't have a sweet chariot. Will they sing the anthem?
They'll sing the anthem.
It's goosebumps just thinking about it. I'm really looking forward to that. And then you're spending some time in France recovering down in the south, and you'll be here hopefully till the final to watch us win it.
Yeah, I'll be here till the final, and I'm a rugby fan, so yeah, I'm pragmatic, and I'm not going to let it, if we get knocked out, it'll be disappointing, but I'm not going to let it spoil my party.
Okay, listen, thank you, sir.
Awesome, thanks, Ross.
And well done.
Thanks, my brother,
appreciate it. Thanks for sharing your story. I know that for listeners, it's been a little bit different to normal, I think, but...
We'll do something in studio when I'm back in Cape Town.
I genuinely want to make a trip happen with you and get some listeners to come along and it'd be amazing.
We have a million ideas. We'll narrow it down.
Okay, we'll pick one. We'll offer it to offer it to our patrons and see what they think.
Yeah, they can do a poll.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks for listening, everyone. Bye-bye.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.